Secession, or the war between the states, and depending on which side you were on, it was not called the Civil War while it was being fought. Most of the things that you and I understand about the Civil War were written after the Civil War was fought, during a period of time called the Reconstruction. Most of the hatred that the South seems to have for the North was generated during a period of time called the Reconstruction. The South did not particularly hate the North prior to and during the War of Secession. If you're in the South, it was called the War of Secession. If you were in the North, it's called the War Between the States. The South did not particularly hate the North. The North did not particularly hate the South. Lincoln made several passionate pleas to the nation that these are brothers and we're fighting brothers and we need to remember that. The same sentiments were expressed on the sides of the South. The hatred that was generated comes about as a result of the Reconstruction at the close of Civil War, which obviously did not take place under Lincoln, as he's assassinated, and under his successor, Johnson. There's some of the most terrible things that take place you can imagine in the South, and the South generates a real hatred for the North. Had the Reconstruction taken place prior to the Civil War, probably the South would have won because they'd have been out for blood because of what took place. But basically, the war between the states, or the War of Secession, begins April the 12th, 1861, not too many days from now. It begins with the firing on Fort Sumter in the state of South Carolina. The South had seceded. They had basically, just like dominoes, one state at a time, decided to back away from the Union. Again, Lincoln was not placed in office till mid-March. He was elected in November, and the states began to secede from the Union as early as mid-December. They said that's it. Lincoln was elected as basically an abolitionist candidate, and it was not at that point that the South feared necessarily they were going to lose the issue of slavery. Okay, again, I hate to keep going over and over this, but I was always taught that the Civil War was the war fought over slavery, and that is nothing could be further from the truth. I just don't appreciate the lies that I was taught. Certainly slavery was an issue, but it was not the issue. The South did not secede from the Union because it feared that it was going to lose the institution of slavery. I read a quote to you from Lincoln last week. Lincoln himself stated that he did not intend to touch the institution of slavery in the states where it existed. I'm going to ask you a question. If the president said that, would you feel like you were threatened? The problem was that the government, the federal government, was taking more and more control of the new territories. And in those territories, they were making policy that stated that slavery would not be allowed to be decided by the voters. It would not be allowed to be decided by the people that live there, but that before the states were even established in these territories, it would be prohibited by law for there to be even an issue of slavery discussed. The South was up in arms over that, and the fact that the government continued to mandate its will throughout the states, it was basically and honestly a war of secession. They just wanted out. They believe that the time of the Constitution had gone too far. They believe that the federal government's control of the states had gone too far. And they decided that the best thing to do was to back out. They believed that the Constitution of the United States was a document that had been entered into by the states at their own will, and that was really a covenant between those states as to what they believed, and that they were free to back out of that covenant anytime they wanted to. The North, on the other hand, believed that the Constitution was a document that by legal bind or whatever held the states of the Union together, and they did not have the right to secede from the Union. And the war was fought over that issue right there. And again, you want it clear in your mind, Lincoln never, as a matter of fact, he stated on at least three or four different occasions, never intended to threaten slavery in the South. Now, you're not going to hear that taught unless you read what Lincoln said. But slavery was not under attack in the South. That wasn't the reason the states began to fight. But they began to withdraw. And conveniently, what the government had done was place federal land in the states. The states were upset about that. They'd gone in and they'd seized land and made federal forts in that land. In other words, Fort Sumter did not belong to South Carolina as far as Lincoln was concerned and the North was concerned. That chunk of real estate belonged to the federal government. And the South was upset, where does the federal government come off owning land? And by what right does the federal government have to come in and claim land that belongs to the sovereign states? Does the Constitution give the federal government that right? And so the South began more and more incensed. The heated debate in Congress certainly was over slavery, and there began to be a polarization in Congress between the North and the South over the issues of slavery. The Dred Scott case, you remember, went to the Supreme Court, and the South won a stunning victory in the Dred Scott case because it was determined that no one had a right to take private property away from you, and slaves were considered private property. And basically, that overthrew the Missouri Compromise, which had been hammered out by Congress, which stated, all right, slavery can exist below a certain line of parallel there, but it cannot exist north of it. The Dred Scott case said, you can't make a law like that, because if a man takes his property north of the line there, he still owns that property. And therefore, if he takes his slaves into Wisconsin, he still owns those slaves, and no government has the right to take his private property away from him. So you see how the battle lines were being drawn and embroiled, and the federal government basically was making laws and policy that the South now began to recognize as not only unethical, but unconstitutional. And so the North, while maintaining that it was pro-Constitution, was making legislation that was unconstitutional in order to preserve the Constitution. And, you know, that's a thought. Where do you violate the Constitution in order to preserve the Constitution? You're into the same thing again, and I guess probably this generation is, with its arguments with Washington and the states now beginning to stand against some of the things going on in Washington, you and I are seeing those lines again, probably clearer than at any time since the Civil War was fought. We're beginning to understand what it is for the government to infringe in the rights of the states, and I mean, there are mandates in Ohio. Certain things that Ohio has to do because of people that live in Arizona. And those mandates are put down blanketly across the country in order for the sake of fairness, and yet the people of Ohio are under those same mandates. There are some books about federal waste that is unbelievable. You know, the big talk has been on federal waste in the last few years, and it started, kind of interestingly enough, on the more liberal side of the camp, pointing fingers at the Pentagon. You know, they were buying $600 toilet seats and $300 hammers and that type of thing, and everybody got up in arms, and then they began to look into the other branches of government. And they were just appalled at what they found. One book, I'll maybe read some excerpts from you next week to you, dealing with some of the waste and fraud. But Washington, D.C. proper, the government offices in Washington, D.C. have a budget of over $1 billion a year for furniture. And that's not even on your budget. That's not even figured into the budget of the United States of America. And they spend that much on furniture every year to take care of government offices. And they had, I can't remember, they had 1,700 or 1,800 aircraft that the federal government owned. And yet most people that fly charter or else commercial when they fly. Of those airplanes, I can't remember, I think it was somewhere around 40 or 50 of them. They didn't even have any idea where they were. Can you imagine owning 40 airplanes, airliners, and not knowing where they are? And some of them that were looking for them found out they had two or three assigned to their own department, didn't even know about it. So, again, that's not to make fun or whatever, but just to say that's how things can get out of hand. And the South basically was looking at the North as though, you know, this is getting out of hand. Consequently, the states of the South began to make decisions for themselves. They figured if there was a time for us to form a new republic, now is the time to do it. They began to secede from the Union. And as they began to secede from the Union, most of the federal forts, most of the federal land, surrendered itself back to the hands of the people. Two places didn't. One is Fort Pickens in Pensacola, Florida. Fort Pickens was never controlled by the South throughout the whole Civil War. I've been there. It's right in Pensacola. Guards Pensacola Bay. And, of course, to look at it, you'd wonder why in the world anybody would want it in the first place. But Fort Pickens never surrendered back into the hands of the people of Florida, nor did Fort Sumter. Fort Pickens, in a little different situation, because it was right out there on the water, had an inestimable amount of food and resources, and felt they could hold out for a year or better if need be, and so there was not an immediate threat there. Fort Sumter only had several weeks or maybe a month of provisions, and so there was concern there. And right after Lincoln took office, beginning here in April, he had informed the newly seceded state of South Carolina that his intention was to reinforce, or at least to replenish, the resources of Fort Sumter. And the South at that time decided, no, this is another country now wanting to bring provisions down here to a fort that was seized from South Carolina land, and they said no go. And the first shots, of course, were fired at Fort Sumter. And that began what's known as the War of Secession between the states. As the thing shapes up, the North has most of the advantages. For instance, there were 23 northern states as opposed to 11 southern states. And the North had about 87 or 88% of all the manufacturing. They had the majority of the land area. They had all kind of advantages to their effect. The only thing that the South had, basically, they had two advantages. Number one was their outdoorsman type lifestyle. Those people were used to living outside. They were used to rugged lives. If nothing else, a farming life will make a rugged individual out of you. And secondly, one of the assets that they had was slavery, believe it or not. One of the reasons the South was able to wreak such havoc with the Northern Army in the first several years of the war was that the slaves stayed home to watch the plantations and freed up the Southerners to go and fight the war. While they were all fighting the war there at Bull Run and places like that, the slaves were back home taking care of the crops. And again, you kind of wonder, if slavery was such a big issue, how could they leave the slaves on the plantations and go off to fight a war? If the war was over slavery, wouldn't you think the slaves would run away and leave? Strange thoughts you get into when you begin to read re-educated history or whatever. Let me give you the list of states that made up the South, and I'll give you the list of states that made up the North. I don't know if you want to take notes on this or not, but for your benefit, I suppose. The southern states, as listed here, are Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee, and Texas. All right, that's Dixie. If you want to know where Dixie is, it's one of those places right there. And those Texans got involved. Some of Lee's greatest generals came out of Texas. And those Texans had fought the war with Spain. Some of them had been around from even shortly after the time of the Alamo. And those Texans, they love to fight. Matter of fact, the Texans right now are involved in a dispute over whether they're going to secede from the Union in 1995. There's already a big movement on, I don't know if you're aware of it, in California as well as in Texas. For those two states, there's a push to secede from the Union. And the problem with Texas was that Texas used to be a country. Texas had its own president. And when Texas came under the control of the United States, it had in its constitution, and still does to this day, if I'm not mistaken, has a statement in there that if they decide to withdraw from the United States, they reserve the right to do so. And so, you've still got some, the war between the states is not over. It still is being fought today, somewhat subliminally perhaps, but it still is going on. And so those Texans, they're a tough bunch of guys, and they come riding across there and get embroiled in the war. Now, the northern states are as follows: Minnesota, Iowa, Kansas, California, for all the good it did, Oregon, for all the good it did, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, and then there are four states where slavery, well, here's another thought, slavery was legal, but they fought for the North. And I ask you another question. If the war between the states was over slavery, what in the world you got four slave states fighting on the northern side for? Okay? Four states that did not secede from the Union were Missouri, Kentucky, Maryland, and Delaware. And those states stayed true to the Union all the way through, although they, at the beginning of the war, reserved their right to secede when they wanted to. They wanted to see how this thing was going to fight. Wanted to see what it was all going to be about. And one other state was formed right in the middle of the Civil War. Anybody know what that state is? West Virginia. West Virginia got so upset with Virginia for dividing that the abolitionist population kind of moved into West Virginia and organized their own state, and mid the Civil War, West Virginia became a reality in an argument there with the state of Virginia. So the lines are drawn. And one of the problems, first of all, in the North was, well, several problems in the strategy of the North. Number one is they're so overconfident. Lincoln believed that this was nothing more than a minor insurrection. The first troops he called up, I believe he called up about 35,000 militiamen, and called them for a stay of 3 months. And Lincoln really believed he was going to take care of this thing in about 3 months and restore order and peace and tranquility and all that good stuff. The difference is he was fighting with some Southern boys. And when them Southern boys get something in their mind, it's hard to get it out. And they, while Lincoln was up here gathering his troops together, they're getting ready to fight. They were prepared to fight. They were prepared to defend their homeland. And truth be known, I'm not an expert, but truth be known, the South lost the war when it decided to invade the North. If the South would have left the North alone, there's no way Lincoln and anybody else would have ever taken the South. When they're fighting for their home soil, them boys are tough. But Lee decided to cross the Potomac, and we'll look at it in a few minutes, decided to march up there into Northern Territory and give them what's for, and some of the most costly decisions he ever made were made right there when he did that. It cost him the war. The first shots of the war fired at Sumter, and really those were not the first shots basically that were of the war. They started the war, and it was in defense of South Carolina soil. And there were a few other skirmishes here and there, but the first big battle of the war between the states comes when Lincoln commands or orders his commanding general, General McDonald, to take the capital of the Confederacy. And the capital of the Confederacy is at Richmond, Virginia. And that's what Lincoln felt was necessary. He decided that if he launched himself down in there and took the Confederate capital, end of story. Jefferson Davis has been elected president by the Confederacy. And again, Jefferson Davis is not a rogue. Sometimes you get these ideas that, boy, the South is just a bunch of, hateful rogues, rebels. You know, that's what they called them. Jefferson Davis, one of the most educated men in America. Jefferson Davis is a powerful political figure. And when you begin to see things like that, the division that occurred was not, all the southern hillbillies went one way and all the northern educated folks went the other way. Robert E. Lee caused Lincoln a lot of tears because Lincoln wanted Lee to command the Union Army. And Lee wouldn't do it. Lee was the most able general in the United States at that time. And Lee decided to defend his native state of Virginia. But Lincoln decides that the best way for him to end this battle quickly is to launch out with an attack. And he orders General McDonald to march on Richmond. And McDonald begins his thrust into the South, crosses the Potomac, takes these volunteers down there with him, and they're going to serve 3 months and go home, and it's all going to be finished and over with. And they march down to a place called Manassas Creek, also known as Bull Run. Not too many miles from Washington. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's only about 27, 28 miles south of Washington, D.C. It was close enough so that along with the Army of the North came several hundred spectators. They came down, you know, in carriages with fringe around it and the little, you know, sun umbrellas to keep the sun off. They were going to come down and watch the battle and see it end, and, you know, it was the end of it. And sure enough, when they set the armies out there and got ready for the battle, all these spectators got back here behind things where they could see and could watch. And they're watching this battle take place. Beauregard is in command of the Southern armies, and boy, they begin to get into the thick of it. And it looked like at the very beginning that the North was just going to rout the South. They marched out there in bold fashion, and the South seemed in somewhat disarray, and they were certainly outnumbered. And the problem with the thing is that a fellow by the name of Sherman comes running into the rescue about midway through that battle. And Jackson comes running into the battle about midway through the thing, and reinforces the Southern troops. And in less than a few hours, the North literally turns, drops its guns, and starts running. It was the greatest rout of the Civil War. As a matter of fact, they ran with such disunity that they actually trampled the spectators, and many of the spectators were killed as the North retreated. The South whipped up on them big time. And so when you hear Southern, he always likes to talk about Bull Run. You know, that was kind of in-your-face type thing. Lincoln came down, and it so upset Lincoln. Now, history doesn't reflect it, but it so upset Lincoln, and you can tell it did, because when he came back, he called for 500,000 troops to come and serve a year. Now, that gives you an idea what Lincoln was planning. He felt like he could do the job with 35,000, and now all at once he's called up 500,000 troops to come and serve a year. Lincoln had been humiliated. And he, from that point on, decided he's going to win the war no matter what it took. Several things come into play during the Civil War where you lost your rights. The battle was over the rights of the states versus the federal control. One of the first things that comes into play during the Civil War is called a compulsory draft. How many of you men know anything about the draft? When did you ever vote on the draft? Does the federal government have the right to come and say, you can't stay at your home with your family, you have to come and join the army? Yes, it does. You know, I mean, what kind of right do you have as an American citizen? I'm not saying we shouldn't defend our country. I'm not saying we shouldn't fight for our country. I'm saying, does the federal government have the right to take you away from your job and your family or your education and say, you must come and go to war and fight? When did you ever vote on that? It was never voted on in America. You never made that choice. That choice was made for you by the federal government. It was made in Washington, D.C., by the armies of the North, when they decided that not only do not states have the rights, but individuals in those states don't have rights. You are required to protect the federal government. You are required to protect the Constitution, whether you like it or not. That is a federal mandate. So Lincoln goes back, calls and raises 500,000 troops, and the war gets in earnest and begins to be fought here. I'm going to just try to, briefly as I can, read you some things about some of the men that fought it, but also give you an idea of how the war goes. From the very inception, the first humiliation that Lincoln suffered at Bull Run, the strategy changed. And the strategy, obviously because of the lay of the land, I should have had a map up here of America. You kind of have to fix it in your mind. But something divides the battle area in half, and that's the Appalachian Mountains. If you ever look at a map, you've got the Appalachian Mountains that start really down in Georgia and come right on up through Tennessee and Virginia and West Virginia, right on up into Pennsylvania and New York, and basically is a blockade between two sides of what now was at war. So you develop into an Eastern Front and a Western Front. And the battle is actually fought on the eastern side and the western side. The battle for the western front goes very well for the north. And again, you have to get in your mind the reason behind it. The reason behind it would be such that the south, being an agricultural community, everything was pushing westward. A lot of the new settlements were out along the Mississippi River. And the North, with its industrial ability, its naval ability, was able to launch its gunboats down the Mississippi. And the battle for the Mississippi went very poorly for the Southern Army. And one of the reasons was a fellow that had come to the forefront there fighting for the North. His name was Ulysses S. Grant. Now, Grant was not in command. Grant was under a commander, but he distinguished himself in this Western theater so much so that eventually Grant will become the commander of the Union Army. The Union Army has about 8 or 9 commanders. They never could figure out who they could put in place to win, and they finally end up with Grant. But Jackson was the fellow that intervened at Bull Run. And when Jackson marched in with his men, the South was on the verge of routing and running. And supposedly, while they were getting ready to throw their guns down and run, Jackson shows up, lines his Virginians up, and somebody said, "Look at those Virginians over there. They're standing like a stone wall." And that's how he got his name, Stonewall Jackson. And he became one of the major contributors to the war. He's killed at Chancellorsville. And again, there are always what-ifs. There are several men that have the consensus that if Jackson had not been killed at Chancellorsville, Lincoln wouldn't have beaten the South. Jackson, one of the bravest generals that Lee had. And between Jackson and Jeb Stuart and some of these men that fought with Lee, he outclassed the Northern Army by far and away with as far as the caliber of leadership that he had. And truth again being seen from the fact that the North, every 2 or 3 months, they were changing commanders. They couldn't figure out who in the world to put in charge of the army, and the South was just wreaking havoc. But Grant begins to launch out in the western part of the country, and if you can get the Mississippi River in mind, as it runs down along the western side of Tennessee and down along Mississippi, that was Grant's objective. And he with Farragut. Farragut had what really consisted of the Mississippi gunboats. He and Farragut fighting together began to fight their way down into Tennessee. I preached a meeting several years ago in Union City, Tennessee. I'll give you an idea where it got its name. Union City was a place that was captured, you know, taken with a railway center in a southern state. And Grant begins to come down into Tennessee. He takes Fort Henry in 1862, marches down in through there, and then takes Fort Donelson. And in Fort Donelson, he surrounds the fort and begins to starve those people out of the fort, which is the common way of doing it. And they sent for terms of surrender, and Grant said, "There will be no surrender. Our terms of surrender are unconditional, complete, and absolute surrender." And U.S. Grant became known as Unconditional Surrender Grant. That's where he became known. He captured 40,000 Confederate troops and cannon and all of that type of stuff there at Fort Donelson in Tennessee. And again, you realize we're moving very slowly here. War starts in 1861. 1862, Grant begins his campaign. But it wasn't like everybody climbs on, helicopters and are, flown to the battle scene, get off, and tanks are running 55 miles an hour and that type of stuff. It took literally weeks and months to move armies. And they're moving on horseback, they're moving with wagons and caissons and things like that being pulled by a horse. The battle develops very slowly. Nothing moves very quickly. And so it is early in 1862 when Grant begins to move against the west and takes Fort Henry and then Fort Donelson. He moves south then, in again following the Mississippi River as his guide. He moves south again, comes to a place called Corinth, Mississippi. Corinth, Mississippi was a major railroad head. And again, you need to understand why they wanted to gain control of the Mississippi River. Number one, it cuts the Confederacy basically in half. It divides Texas and Arkansas and these other states from the rest of the South. Always divide and what? There you go. You always want to divide your enemy. And so the Mississippi River facilitates a perfect avenue of doing that. and they began to proceed down there. Secondly, any supplies that would come up from New Orleans up into the Mississippi River had to be shipped on over into the South. Remember, there are not a lot of seaports along the eastern coast in the South. The great seaport of the South was New Orleans and Mobile and some of those areas in there. And anything that got into the South had to be shipped by rail from those railheads. Corinth, Mississippi was a great railhead. And so Grant begins to attack and make his way towards Corinth, Mississippi, and the Battle of Shiloh. How many of you heard of the Battle of Shiloh? The Battle of Shiloh takes place there. The North basically is defeated at Shiloh. And they're repelled, although it is not for long. General Johnston, who was in command of the southern troops at Shiloh, is killed in the battle. And any time a commander is killed, it weakens the forces. Grant, knowing that, after a setback, he again attacks the area there and finally succeeds in taking the area there at the Battle of Shiloh called Corinth, Mississippi. Commander Pope takes Memphis in 1862, and somewhere between 1862 and 1863 and through there, Grant attacks Vicksburg. That's really the last holdout on the Mississippi River was Vicksburg, Mississippi. And the last strong city left to be taken. New Orleans had been taken. Pope had taken Memphis, and all along through there, the Mississippi River had fallen. So if you just look at the Western Front, it looks like the North is just going to totally destroy the South. And when the Battle of Vicksburg is fought here, Grant attacks and reattacks and can't get them to surrender. And finally, they run back and fortify themselves in the city. And Grant goes really against the ethics of war and launches into a campaign. He shells Vicksburg for 6 weeks, continual shelling. And I mean, there are men, women, and children and all that type of stuff in through there. He shells the city for 6 weeks before the city finally capitulates and gives up. And you know, when you try to glamorize war, there's nothing glamorous about war. It's amazing, you know, these people, when we went into Vietnam, they were all upset about the Vietnamese people and the villagers, and I'm not trying to justify killing of innocent people, but innocent people die in any war. And those same people, you kind of wonder where they were during the Civil War. You know, you kind of wonder where they were at some of those other areas when it was Americans pinned down, getting killed and butchered. You wonder where they were then. And Sherman, I think, said war is hell, if I'm not mistaken. And he probably had the best estimation of it that anybody ever had. He'd seen enough of it. And people die in war. That's the whole idea. And it's not just soldiers that die in war. It's innocent women, children, babies, mothers clutching their babies in their arms. People die in war. And the greatest guarantee that there will be peace is a war. We're headed right now, full steam, full speed ahead toward one of the greatest wars this world's ever known. And if you want to draw a reason for it, it's the United Nations. You want to keep a country from fighting war, you let men who fought a war run that country. You take individuals like MacArthur and Patton and Eisenhower and some of those men, the reason they could keep our country out of war was because they'd been there. They'd seen the bodies. They'd seen the casualties. They knew what it was. They knew what it was to fight a war. And when Johnson and these guys paraded us into Vietnam and Kennedy, you've got individuals that, for the most part, some of these, and again, we're getting way ahead of ourselves here. We'll try not to do that. There's a lot of speculation that Kennedy, he gets his medals because he's a Kennedy. And a lot of fellows like that. You know, you got wealth, you got influence and affluence, and a lot of things happen. I know that a lot of commanders went into Vietnam, fought in one battle. They had a helicopter fly them out to the battle scene, got off the helicopter, stayed 5 minutes, got back on the helicopter and left so they'd get their battle ribbons. And that's what went on. Well, a lot of that goes on. But I tell you what Kennedy had never done. Kennedy had never seen the full-fledged warfare that he said he had seen. And if he had, he'd never put his back over there fighting against those Orientals. MacArthur was the one who said, you better defeat him now, because if you don't defeat him now, you're going to fight him the rest of your life. MacArthur knew his enemy. And Grant begins to march down into the West. Again, the Western Front by 1863, the Mississippi's in control of the North, and it looks as though they've pretty much secured that part of the country. And had the Eastern Front been going as well, the war would have been over in 1863. The difficulty, however, was in the fact that on the Eastern Front, the war was not going well at all. And the North couldn't get things going, couldn't keep things going. And when they did get them going, the South put a great stop to them very quickly. Before I go ahead, let me just pause here and read you a couple of things about one of the fellows. Again, if you want to do some great reading, you can read on the men that fought in the Civil War. I think the youth of America need to be taught to study the men that fought in the Civil War. And again, I was born in the North. My parents were Southerners. I guess I'm a Civil War baby or something like that. But having seen that, the greatest Americans that I can think of were those men that fought in that war between the states. The reason being, they knew they were brothers. And in some cases, literally, the four states that I mentioned that were slave states and yet stayed true to the Union, they had men in both armies. And oftentimes, fathers fought against sons and brothers against brothers on the battlefields. And yet it was a war of honor. If anything can be said about the Civil War, it was that the war was fought with honor. And it was won with honor. You think for a moment, when Lee surrenders at Appomattox Courthouse, his men are permitted to keep their weapons. Now, what battle, what war have you ever seen end where your enemy's allowed to keep their guns?
Vietnam,
yeah, Vietnam got all ours, right. What battle is, and the situation is such that there is such honor among those individuals. When Lee said, if you let them keep their weapons, they won't be lifted anymore in reprisals or in battle against the North. And Grant accepted that. No problem, keep your guns. At Gettysburg, the night before the battle was fought in earnest, those generals on both sides of the line, they'd attended West Point together. They were friends, and some of them were even in-laws. Some of them had married sisters. And they got together at tea and had a meal together the night before they went back to their own lines and then fought one another. It was fought with honor. And while there was a battle taking place the whole time, there was never very far from their realization that the people we're fighting against are our brothers. And you want to see some character, you want to see some patriotism, you study those individuals that fought that war. And how they could have, I mean, they wouldn't even cheat. One of the things, again, that Lee does to cost him the war is he refused to sidestep the Union Army at Gettysburg. Anybody know how far Gettysburg is from Washington, D.C.? About 25, 35 miles, I think. I mean, Lee had gotten that close to the nation's capital. And one of his generals, Longstreet, said, why don't you sidestep the army right here? They're here. They're ready to fight you. They've got the high ground. You're at a disadvantage. Why don't you sidestep them and let's go to Washington and let them come and get us? And Lee said, they've come out here and gone to all this trouble to prepare to fight us. What kind of a general would I be if I refused to give them a fight? Now, that sounds stupid to you and I, but that's the high caliber of character that these men had. They said, hey, we're going to fight this thing fair. If we have to lose by cheating, we're not going to win. Or if we have to win by cheating, we're not going to win. And so, you know, you and I look at that, that shows you how far our society has sunk. That we'd listen to that, we'd think, how stupid. But those men were anything but stupid. They were honorable. And so the war between the states, if anything, was an honorable war. And at the very onset, some great men come to mind. And again, Stonewall Jackson, I suppose, is the great question mark of the Civil War. Had he lived, they said that there was only one man alive that could have stopped Sherman's march to the sea, and it was Jackson. And they said, if Jackson lived, Jackson would have stopped Sherman dead in his tracks, and the march to the sea would have never taken place, and the South would have won. I don't know if that's true or not. But I know this. I know that Jackson was a great Christian. Let me read to you a couple things here. Couple of letters that he wrote, just some excerpts from them, and then I'll read you a story a fellow wrote about his life. Written April the 7th, 1862, to his wife who was ill. He wrote, "Your sickness gives me great concern, but so live that it and all your trials may be sanctified to you, remembering that our light afflictions, which are but for a moment, work out for us a far more exceeding and eternal way to glory." This is a general writing to his wife. "I trust you and all I have in the hands of a kind providence, knowing that all things work together for the good of his people. Yesterday was a lovely Sabbath day. Although I had not the privilege of hearing the word of life, yet it felt like a holy Sabbath day, beautiful, serene, and lovely. All it wanted was the church bell and God's services in the sanctuary to make it complete. Our gallant little army is increasing in numbers, and my prayer is that it may be an army of the living God as well as of its country." Now, that's a guy writing, a general writing to his wife. "On April the 11th, I am very much concerned at having no letter this week, but my trust is in the Almighty. How precious is the consolation flowing from the Christian's assurance that all things work together for good to them that love God. God gave us a glorious victory in the Southwest," he was commenting on Shiloh, "but the loss of the great Albert Sidney Johnston is to be mourned. I do not remember having ever felt so sad at the death of a man whom I had never seen, although I was repulsed in the attempt to retake Winchester," and the story goes on. But again, his Christian character is evident. Let me go ahead and save some time here. This is a rather lengthy article here. If I can find, here it is right here. This was written in 1897, 34 years after Stonewall Jackson's death. The fellow's name was James Power Smith, who had served under him in the Civil War, the guy that wrote this story. "The thoughts of religion began to stir in his heart under the influence of a pious friend at West Point, and were felt with some power when a young lieutenant at Fort Hamilton, he was of his own desire baptized into the Christian faith by an Episcopal clergyman." Okay, now this guy was baptized into the faith by an Episcopal clergyman because he wanted to know God. "The truths of religion of Christ found a deep and abiding place in his heart in the more quiet and regulated conditions of his first years in Lexington, when under the ministry of the venerable Presbyterian pastor, Dr. William S. White, he made a public confession of his personal faith in Christ. Acknowledging his ignorance of religious truth, he came with entire candor and simplicity to be taught as a little child." He didn't get saved after he was baptized into the Episcopal Church. Now, he just wanted to know God. He's willing to do anything. So while he was at West Point, he was baptized in the Episcopal Church, and it was a Presbyterian that led him to Christ. He got saved under a Presbyterian preacher. "The truths he heard were not wholly clear to him, and some things he antagonized with an honesty and courage that were most admirable and sincere seeker after the truth. Only through the process of study, reflection, and prayer, he was led into a clear vision of the great essential truths of evangelical religion. As they came out like stars fixed in the firmament of his upward gaze, he bowed his head and his heart and gave them their rightful authority over all his manhood." And this is one of his own men. "The inspired psalmist declares of the wicked man, God is not in all his thoughts. The supreme fact in the character of Jackson was that far beyond any man of whom we read, God was in all his thoughts. It was not one truth or another about God or one feature of our Christian religion rather than another that became real and dominant to him, but God himself, the living, personal, and present God, became the one transcendent fact and that dwelt in all his thoughts and possessed his whole being. It was not God only as the surpassingly glorious subject of reflection or as the living working and revealing himself in nature and in history, nor as partially known by the Hebrew prophets in the childhood of humanity, but God revealed in Christ, the God of law and love, whose law is love and whose love leads back to the law." That's what this guy thought about the Lord. "I am careful to say this, that I may also say the supreme thought of God gave unity to his religion and unity to his life. As it went down into the hidden nature within, it possessed the whole man and unwanted power and made him one and the same, a man of God within and without. Unto a personal and present God, he gave the undivided faith of his heart. He acknowledged his supreme authority as maker and redeemer over every part of his being and every breath of his life. And that to that authority, he bowed his will implicitly. He came nearer putting God in God's place, said Dr. Stiles, than any man we have ever known. And in this he put himself in one rightful place to which man belongs, the humblest and most majestic, the strongest, the safest, and the happiest that a man can ever occupy. It gave simplicity and directness and personal humility in all uncommon degree. All things were viewed in the light of the supreme fact of God. All things were referred to it. All things were submitted to the rulings of that fact. It covered all other facts and all other truth. It ruled all action. It answered all questions of duty and made all his life and service one and simple forever. How inevitably came his humility. He owed all to God, all that he was, all he had attained, all he had accomplished in the classroom or on the battlefield, and unto him belonged all the praise and glory. Quote, God has given us a brilliant victory at Harper's Ferry today, he wrote from the field. Quote, our Heavenly Father blesses us exceedingly, unquote. On his camp bed in the Wilderness Hospital, when I read General Lee's magnanimous note congratulating him on victory, Jackson had won at Chancellorsville, he replied with emotion, quote, General Lee is very kind to me, but he should give the glory to God. That's the man fighting in the Civil War. How unquestionable was his dependence. As he lifted up his hand in the morning twilight, riding down the field of Fredericksburg, he said, I trust our God will give us a great victory today, Captain. How immediately came his obedience. A friend in Lexington asked him whether he would obey if the Lord bade him leave the home he loved and all that it contained and go on to some mission to Africa. He rose and with intense feeling and prompt decision declared, I would go without my hat. And if asked if I were asked if it were required of him to give up the activity and happiness of life and exquisite happiness of energy and lie on a bed of pain, he said, quote, I could lie there 1,000 years without a murmur if I knew it to be the will of my Heavenly Father. And that's the men that fight in the Civil War. this goes on. I'll not read the rest of it, but you want to do some great reading. There's some great reading involved in that. I read a story not long ago about Jackson as his army was marching. They'd be, you know, marching from one destination to another, sometimes several days in duration. They said that Jackson would get off his horse, take his Bible, and when the first man marched by, he'd start preaching. And he'd preach to them how they needed to be saved and they needed to trust Christ. And he'd stand there and preach till his whole army had gone by. And then he'd have them bring his horse back to him. He'd get on his horse and ride to the front again, get off his horse and do the same thing. And preach to his men. Now, that's the kind of fellows that are fighting the Civil War. You don't hear much about that. You don't hear a lot about that kind of thing. Lee, every morning, was found in prayer and reading his Bible. And again, I'm not trying to slight the North, but the North became so intent on victory, they put a slobbering drunk in command of their forces just so they could win. And that's all Grant was a slobbering-faced drunk. And there was no honor in Grant other than what he encountered from his opposition. But the honor was those men, and even some of the men that preceded Grant were more honorable than he was. Grant was just able to win because he evidently stayed drunk, didn't know what he was doing. Those are some of the men that are fighting the war. And you need to remember some things about the Civil War. First of all, it wasn't a war over slavery. Slavery did not become part of the conflict until the very end. Lincoln freed the slaves the last year of the Civil War. Lincoln didn't have any intention of touching slavery in the South when he started the war by his own words. The war wasn't a war of slavery. It was a war of federal government as opposed to states' rights. That's what the war was about. Second thing you need to remember about the war is the fact that the North attacked the South. Okay? What does that mean? The South had declared its independence. It had seceded from the Union and established itself as a free and independent nation. Therefore, the North attacked a sovereign nation. And you need to remember that this greatest character that ever can be found anywhere is in the Civil War. There's several volumes of books called Lee's Lieutenants. Probably some of the greatest books written on leadership that there are anywhere. And you'd do well to read them. They'd be good for you. All right, now then, the war front in the East, and we're going to close out here in just a second. While the war in the West went very well for the North, the war in the East, on east of the Appalachian Mountains, did not go well at all. They couldn't find a commander to get the job done. In 1862, in February, Lincoln puts McClellan, and McClellan takes control of the army. I mean, since his first fellow had been humiliated there at Bull Run, he puts McClellan in charge and orders McClellan again to take Richmond, feeling if he can take the capital of the South, then he will obviously sustain a victory there. And McClellan marches towards Richmond. And he does so basically unhampered. McClellan basically throws the war away because McClellan ends up at Richmond, and rather than attack, he decides to wait and get reinforcements. He not only wants to take Richmond, he wants to decimate the whole town. He wants to wipe it out. So he sends word back and says, send me reinforcements, and he waits on his reinforcements. Again, takes time to move an army. By the time his reinforcements get there, Lee has reinforced the South, and again, McClellan turns and starts running. He couldn't take the capital. And as a matter of fact, at that point, Lee was not in command of the Southern troops, but Lee does such a tremendous job, Lee is now placed in command of the troops. Well, after McClellan, Pope is put in control of the Union Army. And Pope, while McClellan was too lax in confidence, he didn't believe he had enough men to take Richmond, Pope was overconfident. And Pope goes running back down to Richmond, and he gets to a little place called Manassas Junction, which is Bull Run, and the second Battle of Bull Run takes place. And it kind of ends up like the first one. So Pope is routed, and he's sent flying, and again, it's like one commander after another, and in 1862, Stonewall Jackson, and he hit Pope so hard, he never did fully recover. And so the war goes on. I'll have to continue next week because we're out of time, but it was one loss after another on the east side for the Union Army. Yes? My own opinion for the South loss is, number one, they crossed the Potomac and went north into the north.
Well, but I don't mean tactically, I mean spiritually. I mean, why did God allow them to?
I don't know. I have no idea. Was God on the side of the South? I don't know, See, if you do that, particularly with the slavery question, I don't think the Lord was ever for the institution of slavery as it existed in the South. Sometimes when you talk like I talk, people say, well, you're just an old slaveholder. And really, I'm not. I don't believe that God was pro-slavery as it existed in the South. But at the same time, does God need the political arena the way it's supposed to be? I don't know. The North certainly had about 70% of the population behind its viewpoint. And the consensus of America at that time, 70% of the people obviously believe that the federal government should have control, and 30% believe it shouldn't. So does a minority have a right to revolt against the majority? I don't know. I am confused. I know that the South had all the manpower and the ability to whip the North if they'd have... And I think, really, in my thinking, strategy speaking, the loss was because the South wasn't content to win. All they had to do to win was protect their own borders. That's all they had to do. They didn't have to invade the North, see? And so I think the South got out of whack when they, like I said, when Lee crossed the river and went north into the North, I think he stepped out of bounds. And at that point, I think the Lord just said, uh-uh. Nope. So. Well, I don't know that you can draw a line there. Like I said, there are some good God-fearing men in the Army of the Potomac. The leadership of the Southern Army was more God-fearing, certainly, than the Northern leadership was. There's not any doubt about that. There were more churches in the South. But to say, well, the South was spiritual and the North wasn't, I'm not, I don't know that you can go that way. I don't think that you can make it an issue of God and the devil. I think there's some incidences in history that are just, you know, nation rising up against nation and doesn't have anything to do necessarily with God, although there's certainly spiritual principles involved in all of those things. And, you know, it's an amazing thing to find when these men could have, you know, killed thousands of people, a lot of times they just back away because they just didn't believe that's the way it was to be done. You know, send them home. And it was an honorable way to fight a war. I mean, people die, and it was a nasty war and an ugly war, but it was honorable in the sense that they wouldn't do anything to shame their name. You don't hear a lot of atrocities coming out of the South. You hear some of these raiders that came up out of Texas. Was it Morgan's Raiders and some of these guys? But those are some of those guys that fought against those Mexicans down there and picked up some habits. Those are not God-fearing men. As a matter of fact, the South had as much trouble with some of those raiders as they did them good. You know, they'd come up into the North and kill and ransack, and you find Lee was not altogether happy with those men either. So, I don't know. I don't know that you can make it a spiritual issue, but certainly you can see the decline of a spiritual nation. In that, you know, if you take this book, you don't need a government. And I say that humbly. I mean, I say that in support of an American government. But people don't need governing if they've got a book that governs their lives. You don't have to worry about a Christian that holds this book as his authority, breaking into your house, stealing your goods, murdering your children, molesting your children, raping your... You have to worry about that. If this law is honored, you don't need government. And because of that, when Christians put this government together, they were not pro-strong government. But the worse society has become, the stronger and stronger and stronger government has become. And then government becomes infiltrated with wicked men, and then you got a real problem. You got a real problem. I mean, you look at the last few elections we've had, and it hadn't been an issue of leadership. It hasn't been a foreign knowledge or foreign policy. It's been, you know, who's in the worst scandal? You know, who's running around with whose wife, and how many affairs has he had on his wife? And, I mean... in Isaiah, in the decline of Israel, there's a passage there in the first few chapters of Isaiah where it said they'd take a little child and said, you be over this mess. You know, they put him in charge and authority because they couldn't find somebody that wanted it. So they just take whoever would, you know, you be in charge. And that's basically where America is now. The last four elections have been the choice between the lesser of two evils.